We are very excited today to introduce the world to a mutual friend of ours and a friend of the show. If you've loved our amazing artwork and logos, you can thank Spencer Nutella. Did I say that right? Spencer, say how your name is
Nutella.
Pronounced.
Nutella.
Nutella.
Yes.
You can thank our friend that we're having on the show today, and also fellow martial artist, a Wing Chun cat, a Goju Ryu cat, and someone that's just picking up judo that's going to be a part of his repertoire as well. Spencer Nutella. Did I get it right?
Yes, sir.
Awesome.
Oh, yeah. There we go.
Spencer, thank you so much for being on the show today, man.
Yeah, super appreciate Welcome. It. Obviously, you know, we talk a bunch and BS quite often. But yeah, it's fun to actually hop on and get something going here.
So let's start you off just like our other guests. Mm-hmm. Tell us your kung fu origin story, my friend.
All righty. So I don't think it's actually too dissimilar from a lot of people, right? You know, there's like two groups of people. There's people who start off in one thing and somehow they stick through it through literally like their entire life. And then there's people who tend to have experience in a couple of different things. And I was the latter. When I was about four, probably just about to turn about five. So five for all intents and purposes. Apparently I was a pretty unruly child. And so like a lot of parents, with the same story, I found my, you know, my mom put me in, martial arts. She put me into like an introductory karate course. And for whatever reason, it either worked out for her or I was liking it, you know, to whatever extent that a young child can. And, so soon after that, she put me in something a little bit more permanent, or long-term, I guess. And that was Warangdo school. So a more contemporary Korean system. I did that for probably close to 10 years, went through the whole, you know, the youth program, all that fun stuff, the youth belt rank system. And actually the way that I found Wing Chun was pretty funny. So I had friends who practiced different martial arts. I had one friend who was obsessed with Bruce Lee. So he first went down like the JKD angle. And then he found a Wing Chun school in my hometown. So we would practice. He started practicing Wing Chun a bit. We also played a lot of like Dragon Ball Z cards and all that kind of fun stuff and would watch Kung Fu movies. So, you know, my buddy, he was the one that first kind of introduced me to Wing Chun. And he was like, Spencer, I think you might like I think you might like a little bit of what we got going on. I was like, oh, okay, why? And Warangdo, if you're familiar with it, is less kick heavy than a lot of like Korean systems.
Yep.
There was certainly a ton of contact work that we would do. And I was super young. It's not like I was like, you know, like super comprehensive in any of this, but, anyways, it's just a little bit more like hand activity, I would say, a little bit closer range stuff. And he was like, yeah, no, we do close range stuff. I know you talk about like, you like to punch, you know, more in like competitions and blah, blah, blah. So I was like, okay. And he was like, all right, let me show you Chi Sao. I was like, okay. So he starts trying to show me Chi Sao in my bedroom. And, so I'm sitting there trying to understand, you know, like, okay, Tan Sao, Bong Sao, Fuk Sao, and we're kids. So we're laughing about it. Right. I'm trying to understand like the hand shapes and get the idea of it and like understand the rolling. And the whole time he's like, you know, relax more, relax more. And, he was like, so you feel for an opening, like when you feel there's like an opening, that's when you strike. And again, kids, not a very comprehensive understanding of what we're doing here. So anyways, I was down in Tan Sao and I went to roll up instead of rolling into Bong Sao, I just slapped him in the face and he turned a cartoonish shade of red, like steam pouring out the ears kind of thing, threw me down and just started wailing on me. And I was just like, whoa, dude. And I remember he was just like, never do that again. When I'm showing you something, you don't do that. And like, he got like super aggressive. We're still super good friends, but he like kind of like snapped in that moment. And after that, I was like, okay, well, maybe there's something to this, you know? And so he was practicing at a school down on like a block off of like Main Street in downtown Vancouver, Washington, right next to Portland, Oregon, part of the Portland metropolitan area. Anyway, so he was practicing at school down there. And at first my mom wasn't cool about like me doing something different. Also, I think it was like more expensive than what I was previously doing. So obviously that plays a role. Anyways, I grew up skateboarding and all this kind of stuff. So I would skate downtown like every day after school, especially once I was in like middle school. So at this time I would have been. And yeah, so I'd like get out of school. Me and my buddies would either go meet up downtown or I would just go skate by myself. Anyways, I would start skating by this Wing Chun school and, eventually start just kind of like lurking around there. And, you know, time goes on. I had some friends that had joined up that quit, but I ended up practicing there for a bit. And it was something that I don't know. I was kind of like, I actually really like this. There I didn't do the most like comprehensive training, I would say, or it wasn't as foundational as like my Wing Chun training in my 20s. But there was a ton of Chi Sao, tons of drills, tons of Si Lim Tao. And so it was just something that kind of like stuck with me for quite a bit. Now, naturally, I think as some people become adults, they like go into a little bit different things in life. And like, I certainly lived it up when I was like later teenage years and early adult years. I curbed that pretty quick though. I mean, my wife and I, we got married when I was like 23. We were pretty young when we got married. So I had a couple of years off, I would say, from like active martial arts practice where I was just kind of screwing around and not really doing a whole bunch of stuff. I did have a friend when I lived in Japan, from Taiwan who had practiced Wing Chun and some other stuff. And I got to practice with him for probably about like 9 months. And then he moved on and did some other stuff. He was traveling and whatnot. But then it was in my 20s. So early 20s when my first daughter was pretty young and I was kind of like, I'm getting kind of out of shape. I need to start doing a little bit more active stuff again. I found my new Sifu, who was a very, very, very profound person. I would say in my life and in my understanding of martial arts, actually originally just because of his understanding of martial arts, but me kind of taking what he said and understanding like some deeper levels. Anyways, I met him in my 20s and started practicing at a Chinese-run organization here in Portland, Oregon. I took to it pretty quick. I had to change some stuff from my previous system. That was fine. I was totally okay with it because I have so much confidence in my teacher's abilities and understanding that it was not the biggest thing for me to switch it up a little bit. Practiced with him up until pretty much like at some point during early COVID.
Now, Spencer, yes, real quick. Now, this is still Wing Chun, correct?
Yes. And this is the lineage that I currently practice, which is the Holun lineage.
Would you take a minute and tell the audience? Because, you know, you and I are kind of funny. When we both started talking to each other, I had reached out to you because I had noticed one of your wooden dummy videos.
Yes.
And I've seen probably, you know, 150 to 200 wooden dummy videos. But there was a small section in there that you were performing. And I'm like, I haven't seen anything like that except for the Wong Q lineage. And I reached out to you and you were kind enough to say hello. This was almost two and a half years ago.
Yeah, it's a couple years back.
Yeah, it's been a couple of years back. And a lot of people are not familiar in the West with Wong Q. But as much as I study the Wing Chun lineage, lore, history, all that other stuff, I had never heard of Ho Lien. Could you tell us a little bit about Ho Lien and who he was in the Wing Chun overall arc, as it will be?
Yes. Yeah. So he was a restaurateur. So he was also another one of Ip Man's students who didn't necessarily go, you know, really trying to actively teach much. But he did have his kind of like inner, you know, group of people that practiced with him. Anyway, so he started practicing with Wing Chun, I believe, or not Wing Chun. He started practicing with Ip Man around, I think, 1962 or 63. There was one of his schools in Hong Kong that opened up around 62. And that's when Ho Lien started practicing there. Then in 63 to 65, Ip Man apparently taught out of the storage room in the restaurant that Ho Lien ran. And so, yeah, for a couple of years, it was practicing there. Anyways, and then, you know, after that, you know, Ip Man obviously moved schools a couple more times or whatever. And Ho Lien continued to practice with him. I also believe his oldest son, Danny, was able to practice with him directly under Ip Man a little bit as well.
Oh, wow.
But anyways, he practiced with him to the greatest ability that he could up until his death. I don't know how intensive like the later years were, but he was there, and practicing with everybody. He also helped a lot with the wooden dummy creation and work. So he had this guy, I have some photos of stuff that he has made and it's insane. So he like obviously had the resources and the tools to do like fabrication and manufacturing of stuff. So he made that like, I mean, he could build motors. Like he made that motorized dummy that pulses.
I've seen that one. Looks like an advanced sex machine almost.
It absolutely looks like some kind of sex toy. but it's interesting. You know, it's something to say, hey, I'd like to get my hands on that and mess around with that for a little bit at least. Anyways, he made a ton of different types of devices for training, contraptions, all sorts of weird stuff. Even spring arm dummies, which is weird. So he was making spring arm dummies. I'd never even seen that he had made them, but I started making some just on my own because I thought it was going to be a good idea. And now I kind of love it. But anyways, he was a guy that was tooling around helping like Kusong with like the dummy creation and specs and all that kind of stuff. He just had the tools and the resources to actively do all that kind of stuff. So he was an interesting guy, but again, he didn't, particularly try to teach like a big group of people. It just so happens that the version that ended up over here in Portland, Oregon, was of his lineage.
That's pretty cool. And you're continuing also a little bit with one of Calvin? His students, Calvin.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So Calvin began training with him under Holun in 1980. And Calvin has inherited all of the dummies that Holun had created. I think he actually inherited the Bacham Dol that Holun made.
Wow.
Which I have some photos of. Calvin is a very, 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 he's someone that I respect a lot. And I've only known him for the last maybe 2 years or something, maybe not quite, but, I tracked him down because throughout some point in COVID, I kind of lost contact with my Sifu and hadn't been able to really reestablish it, but I was kind of like, nah, this lineage is, I really like it. I want to continue this. I think there's so few people that probably practice it that it's something that I want to kind of have for me. And I was like, so sure. I know there's other groups of Wing Chun in Portland. Wing Chun tends to really struggle here for some reason, but, anyways, there's some other groups of Wing Chun in Portland, completely different lineages, which is fun to go practice with them. So I do meet up and practice with these people. And I truly enjoy it, but I don't necessarily feel like I want to, change what I've programmed into my body thus far. I don't want to really go adapting it at this point. So I tracked down Calvin. I went on like internet hunt, found out that he was teaching tennis at a club in Hong Kong. I had seen some like reference, I had seen some videos of him just online explaining that he practiced the Holun lineage. And like one of them was him doing the dummy form. And I was like, oh yeah, that's the dummy form. Or like, that's how we do it. And so I was like, all right, I'm going to find this guy. Anyways, I eventually did, got in contact with him. And now we, you know, just like on WhatsApp, talk all the time, share videos. I actually ran through my forms with him and was like, point out where there are differences or point out what you think I should focus on or whatever it is. So he's a really good resource for me now, just for my understanding of how Holun taught and, how he taught him.
Man, that's a great story.
That is a great story.
That's a great story, really.
I feel like I went kind of like creepy hunter though on the internet. But I'm glad I did.
So. I hear stuff like that and I think I would do, I've done stuff like that. So yeah, yeah, definitely. That's super cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So Calvin,
found your Sifu since COVID?
No, it's unfortunate. It's okay. I've come to terms with it. There's no feelings of resentment whatsoever. I understand that he's a person who has, his own life, his own children, his own family to worry about. And at some point throughout COVID, basically classes entirely stopped. We had been doing some, you know, I have probably, I don't know, 15 or no, like probably have like 20 like videos that he has sent over for just training things on that. And so I go through and it's like, that latest episode of Ahsoka where she's like watching Anakin teaching and stuff like that. It's like that. Mm-hmm. So I'll go through and I'll watch those videos and I'm like, oh yeah, I'm noticing this little nuance here, or, oh yeah, that's how he explains it. Yeah. Yeah. So, but unfortunately, I don't get to cross hands with him or anything like that anymore.
That's a bummer. Where in your journey, because when you mentioned this the first time, I was kind of blown away by it. So at some point in your martial arts journey, mm-hmm. you decided to find and look for Goju Ryu karate. Yes. You actually looked for it because you thought that it would be a good add-on to your current training with Wing Chun. Could you explain that story and tell us your mindset of that?
I was very particular. So because of, you know, training kind of going out the window, or at least physical hand-to-hand contact going out the window throughout COVID. Sorry if that gets this episode flagged, by the way.
No, it's fine. It's fine.
I feel like just mentioning the word gets you a flag. Anyways. So, you know, hand-to-hand kind of training like went out the window through COVID. I was like, I need it though. Like, I need to find something. I need to find some way to, be working on things diligently and within some kind of structure. I need that. And so I did big old internet deep dives on different systems that were at least offered close by. And fortunately, there was a Goju Ryu school, and I'm literally wearing the hoodie for this, the dojo that I made. I made the hoodie for the dojo, but anyways, I found this Goju Ryu school, and I was like, okay, so this is a close range art that's a derivative of, in to some degree, the Southern Chinese arts.
Yeah.
To some degree have some kind of crane influence in there, crane method, crane boxing influence in there. Lots of focus on connectivity, on balance, on harmonies, and all this kind of stuff. And I was like, okay, well, I'm going to give it a go. That's the one I'm going to try out for a little while here. And yeah, it got me what I was looking for. I was able to, and I, you know, still I'm able to take out of it what I need and what I want. I feel like my practice is probably, you know, a bit different from a lot of people in there. Just because everybody's kind of looking for different things and everybody has different goals and aspirations and levels of experience. But I am able to find what I wanted, and I'm able to, I think, really further my understanding of martial arts as a result.
Do you think that you're able to extrapolate what you want out of Goju is because of your previous principle-based training like we had talked about mm-hmm. privately? With the Wing Chun, do you think the Wing Chun was a lens that you can look at your Goju and have some really deep understanding of maybe what's going on there?
Yeah. So visually, if you look at just like the base mechanics, you're going to find a lot of similarities. You might see things surface a little different, but with the understanding of the application, to me, it was not quite a one-to-one crossover, but it was very close. To the point where I could at least make it my own, or I could make it work for me, I should say. I could make it work for me. Like, so I can go into my dojo and I can kind of try to shift gears a little bit and operate, you know, a little bit more under kind of the strategy or, the movement that you would kind of like find in Goju, or just like the application in general. At the same time, I can kind of like switch gears back and go, okay, I'm going to go a little bit more of like a Wing Chun approach here. I'm able to find a common ground, but the thing is, there's not really any contradiction between them. You could probably find like some things here and there. And then that would just kind of depend on how the person wants to personally use it. I feel like Goju doesn't really offer up, absolutes, you know, half hard, half soft. There's always going to be something in between. And who's to say what's right or wrong. So that's where I found it was just like a good vessel for me to kind of try to operate within. And find my practice, but certainly, or find meaning in my practice, but certainly I would say that my previous experience gave me some really good groundwork to basically have me hit the ground running, and kind of advance, my comprehension of the system. If that makes sense.
Totally. Totally. Before we go on, I want to ask you, to your best ability, would you explain, because most of the audience, I'd say 90% of our audience are Kung Fu cats. We have a few different practitioners that listen to our show as well. But I've been saving this question for you for this show. I've never really asked you this question, but I've been saving it over here. I'm like, if we ever get Spencer on the show, I want to ask him this one. But before we ask you that question, would you explain to us what Bunkai is? Bunkai, and what you think people are missing these days in their karate practice with Bunkai.
Okay, so deep question, because there's kind of like the prescribed Bunkai of a system, and then there's the encouragement of oil of, or like your own personal self-exploration, which is crucial, I would say. So the prescribed Bunkai, the prescribed Bunkai is going to give you a recommended usage, typically focusing on the greater mechanics and how you can effectively use them. I want to make sure I explain this well.
Okay, that's okay.
The greater mechanics and how you can use them and how they tie into the rest of the system as a whole. Essentially, what makes that ends up kind of becoming maybe the glue a little bit. Like you look at the prescribed Bunkai in one system. It could be one version of, you know, one lineage of Goju-ryu compared to another lineage of Goju-ryu. Ideally, the themes in Bunkai in one system should be consistent throughout the Bunkai for the rest of the kata, so that you're focusing on the same mechanics, you're focusing on the same structure, and you're using it together as a unit. That's not to say that somebody can take those mechanics and interpret them differently and use them in a different way, and become proficient with them. But that only gives you, for the most part, if you're looking at the prescribed Bunkai, that mainly gives you a pretty just like general idea, you know? But that's where you have to say, okay, so what was strong about this technique or something that I did? What made it strong? What was the connection in the body? And then, okay, well, where else would this apply? So when you start digging into the world of oyo, that's basically an opportunity to pressure test things. Say, well, I can physically get into this position, but do the mechanics that I'm practicing in the Bunkai actually make it strong? I can physically get here, but does that mean that I should? If I can get here and try to do this, but it's going to have a really low success rate, should I maybe be doing that? You know, it's like, okay, well, maybe you shouldn't. Maybe you should move on. Maybe you should look at it from a different angle. Does that kind of? No, that does.
So what you're talking about, at least in my understanding of what Bunkai is it's kind of where the rubber hits the road, where how do you take that movement and find an application out of that movement? And I think too many people fall in love with that word application instead of actually, because you and I talk about this a lot, actually looking at the movement and being like, well, that might be a high rising block, or are you striking somebody to the neck with that, or are you elbowing somebody and you're pulling them into you? So how does Bunkai relate back to, I don't know, application in your mindset? And do you think application is just, well, when they do this, I do that? Or do you think that application can be what you're talking about a little bit with, how do I apply my weight? How do I apply my balance? How do I apply the structure? Is that also, do you think, maybe something that people are missing when they look at something like Bunkai?
I think a lot of people do probably look at it as, when they do this, I do that kind of thing. I think, and maybe that's fine for some people. If people are okay with doing that and that's how they want to get proficient in things, cool. But let's see here. For me, especially in martial arts that have a, you know, strong emphasis on connection and post-contact work and feeling, I think it ultimately becomes less of you do this, I do that. It ultimately becomes, I can feel this, so this is where it's going kind of thing. And the, this is where it's going, I think you got to get it to a point where it's not planned. It's just got to be, that's why the repetition of practicing Bunkai or the repetition of practicing kata, you know, you're going to build strong foundations for what you're doing with all that repetition. So I really feel that it's just, once you've felt some kind of contact in some way, that's when you just got to let your body do work with whatever's going on. It shouldn't be planned. And I think Actually, well, here, there's that term that you told me to steal your phrase. So I'm going to steal your phrase on your show.
Okay.
We are consciously training the subconscious.
Yes.
And it's that subconscious movement. It's that subconscious movement that I'm talking about based on feeling. So yeah, I think that's how it kind of all relates.
It's
feeling. Yeah.
It's definitely got a bridge to the chi sal mindset. Because because you were talking about that a little bit too when we were talking. It's like, you know, you had said that, you know, there is a feeling quality and a feeling dynamic when you're crossing hands with someone that you work on in Goju that you feel like a lot of the other practitioners just don't understand. Because that goes back with one of our previous excellent guests was Sifu Russ. Sifu Russ was talking. He's like, listen, people are executing Goju at the wrong range. Mm-hmm. It's not an outside art. You're up and smell, you know, it's a little bit like Wing Chun. We call it a smell your breath boxing to see if you brushed your teeth that day. Mm-hmm. A lot of good Goju is executed when you guys are not quite in the grappling range, but in that mid range where, you know, you're definitely on top of each other. And you're not so much in a long distance kicking and striking range. And then you can actually feel their bridges. Yes. You can actually feel all of that stuff. Would you say that that's part of the equation that maybe people in Goju and maybe even other systems of up close karate are missing?
So, well, okay. So the versions of like, you know, basically the tactile sensitivity training drills within Goju and other systems of karate are going to be kakie. Kakete, kakedameshi. And these are all different types of, you know, sensitivity, you know, training drills. The thing is, look, there's obviously like the misnomer of like push hands where people kind of have this idea that it's a physical strong push. I think a lot of people at least that I've seen within like I'll just use push hands as a term within karate. A lot of the stuff that I see a whole lot of, a whole lot of force, and that's okay in terms of like working up like some kind of conditioning. And I think even with push hands, it shouldn't just be all super or sticky hands, whatever, chi sao, sensing hands, listening hands. I don't think it should just be super light and soft all the time. I think you obviously have to start building up pressure, power, speed, things like that as people get more proficient. But I think people tend to maybe want to jump to that stage within the realm of like Okinawan martial arts without doing a lot of the groundwork for actually the listening and feeling of the energy. And that's something that at least when I practice with people, I'm saying things that sound like it's coming out of like a Wing Chun class. I'm like, you know, we'll be pushing and I'll be like, okay, I'll be like, tuck the elbow in a little bit, loosen up the shoulder. You know, tighten up the lat maybe over here, be dependent on your structure more than just like your muscle power. It's a lot of that kind of stuff. And I honestly feel like myself and others get better practice out of that than just pushing and pushing and pushing. The opposite reaction of push is pull or give, like use that to your advantage. That's the listening that you want to be going for. So I do think people could benefit from maybe taking a step back sometimes and softening things up and, you know, trying to explore it from that angle, but I don't know. That is one area though, specifically where I do feel there are certain little disconnects.
Excellent. Owen, did you have anything for Spencer?
Sorry if I'm rambling. It's hard for me to not ramble. I've never been accused of being brief.
We love the rambling. Keeps the show rolling on. So I've got one for you off of that. So. Mm-hmm. I like to look at the world in general that's martial arts, not just through the kung fu lens. I'm looking at some of the, you know, Indonesian knife fighters and the Filipino stick fighters and things like that. MMA, Owen and I are both big fans of MMA and, different, all kind, even the sport martial arts. And I keep an eye on my karate friends. And something that I've noticed is let's go back to Bunkai. And let's go back to application. So looking at the movement through the kata to come up with the application, I found that a lot of people with their karate these days are almost MMAizing it. You know, they'll be like, okay, well, if you look at this movement, you could do it, it's actually a movement that you could do on the ground and choke somebody out, just like Brazilian jiu-jitsu. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of people have thrown away their reverse punches and they've added on, you know, like a jab cross that you would find in Western boxing. Mm-hmm. Do you think that there is a line at some point where, okay, now you're just adding on a bunch of stuff from over here, over here, and over here that you like, and you're mm-hmm. saying that, oh, look, it's been here in karate this, it's been here in my karate this whole time. We just didn't know how to interpret it. But now we're interpreting the movements for modern day application and they're kind of MMAizing it, if you will. Do you think that's a little bit different than how you're looking through the lens of your bunkai with?
That's a good question. So I don't think people are wrong to find examples that maybe they didn't consider before. Or maybe they just didn't figure out how to recognize yet. I think I know what you're talking about. A lot of people do those videos and it's like, you know, it'll show like a segment of a kata and then it'll show like a part of like an MMA fight and it'll be like, oh, this was that. I think that's what you're talking about, right?
That's a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't think it's, yeah, I don't think there's anything wrong that they are looking for those kind of connections. I don't know if it's the way that I look about connections. I would say, man, this is a hard one, dude.
we can come back to this one if you want, Spencer.
It's okay. I'll try to put something together here. That's not the way that I look at applications. I look at applications based on like feeling and force and mechanics and structure. And I think if you're looking at things from just like an outside visual perspective, you might not necessarily be considering those things. You might just see the physical shape of something and be like, that's this. That might not necessarily be true. Some examples, I saw something recently, I'm not going to point anything out, but it was talking about like, basically what would be like a Wing Chun Tansao, but coming out like from the side of the body this way, going that direction, like dealing with something from like a full on side stance. And, you know, sure, the arm structure kind of looks like a Tansao, but is the application going to be used the same? Is the body structure is clearly different. That's where I think there might be a little bit of a risk in trying to say, oh, this is this or this is that or whatever. But I don't know. Sorry, you kind of stumped me on that one a little bit.
That's all right. Again, you can come back to that one later. If maybe it clears the air and you can add on to that. So at what point in your training did you start designing your own wooden dummies? Because if anybody follows you, and we'll have the links, by the way, when we do the show notes, we'll have the links because you're mainly on Instagram right now for now.
Yeah.
But you're over at Goju Spencer. But if anybody looks at your backyard, that thing is scattered with, makiwari that you've handmade and a bunch of wooden men that you've handmade. At what point did you start, using your carpentry skills to kind of follow in Julian's fabrication kind of lineage, if you will?
Yeah, that one honestly just kind of came about. Like I got to be doing something at all times kind of thing. I'm always working on something creative in some regard. So when I, in my early 20s, when I began practicing under my new sifu, I was like, I need to practice like a lot. Like I want to practice at home. I want to be doing all this stuff. So I got a CB antenna joint for like a big, you know, truck antenna, a super strong joint, drilled a hole into a dowel, mounted it on a wall and put a wall bag on it. And I just started practicing like that. And it would just be, you know, like paktanda, you know, just like different. Well, I'm not slapping stuff off my table here. Sorry. But no, I would just go through different things and like, I would just get all that repetition in and feeling, and I would try to incorporate stepping and incorporate the junma and all this kind of stuff. So I was probably like, early 20s or something at that point, 24, 20, 25 or something. And I made that thing and I used that. I still have one. I have multiple versions now, but I absolutely love it. I call it a Jiu Kakia because a Kakia is that traditional Okinawan, kind of like arm training device, where it's just the post with the arm that either goes up or down and resets however you want. That one obviously only goes up and down. So the, why I call this one a Jiukakia is it's got the arm, but I can move it in any direction freely. Then sometime during COVID, I was like, again, not being able to practice, where I was training Wing Chun, I was like, oh, I need a wooden dummy. So I talked to some buddies who do like tree work, cut down trees and all that kind of stuff, or trim branches. And I was like, hey, you guys got any logs? And one of my buddies was like, sure, bring a truck over. Took a truck over there. He just cut it to the size I wanted. He cut me some extra like long branches that I could use for the limbs. And I researched the dimensions for the Ip Man dummy and, built it to the best of my ability. And I think it turned out pretty good. It's a dead dummy, so it doesn't have that shake, but I've actually learned to really enjoy working with a dead dummy. Mainly because like, if you're not actually firmly rooted in your structure and you push against it, it's just going to push you back. I like that I focus a little bit more on like a strong root right now as a result. But anyways, yeah, it was COVID. I just started going crazy with like building stuff, built the wooden dummy. I built the floating dummy, based on a recommendation from a friend, Dave, who practices a lot of different unique stuff. But he had a dummy that he made that was suspended, and he actually had the leg attached as well, but it was suspended and it could move and shake back and forth. Mm. And so rather than stepping around the dummy to, you know, engage with it, you could pivot in your stance with it. And I have a lot of fun doing that, especially if you get a little bit of force behind it. It's heavy. It'll knock you back if you're not rooted. So I made that. I have a lot of fun with that. The Faozhong floating dummy. God, I've made all sorts of other stuff. You sent me those carving boards for the Wing Chun knives. I made a positive rake set and a negative rake set. I like stabbers, but choppers look cooler. So, you know,
it's true. It's true. It's true. So a question about your art, where did you find that? And do you do that for your career? I mean, I'm not even sure what you do, brother. What are you doing?
I work in the very interesting realm of UX prototyping software. So very fun, actually. But anyways, no, I don't do art for a career. I have always had like some kind of connection to a media related industry. So, you know, I worked in skateboarding and snowboarding a lot when I was younger. And then when I, via connection through skateboarding, got my in to the software industry, and I was doing a lot of like design, marketing, advertising, web management for a software company. And then that turned into, oddly enough, sales for a different software company. but also within like the design and media and entertainment realm. And then just through connections that I've literally built from that first connection from skateboarding to software, I'm still working with that family. I'm just in the prototyping world now, but that's also a lot of media related projects. So, my art stuff, nope, it's mainly just hobby. Do a lot of photography stuff as well. I have pretty much relegated that to hobby as well. I've definitely done like commercial gigs over the years, done stuff for professional sports teams and, skateboarding magazines and things like that. But I just, yeah, I keep it fun. I keep it just a hobby now.
That's awesome. Nice. That's awesome.
Actually, dude, I have all these, you've seen a bunch of these already, but I mean, like I have all these like, paintings of like these guys here.
Yeah. Yeah. All the classic karate masters.
Yeah. I got to keep working on that.
I love that. I love that. Here's an interesting question for you. So you are, not to blow too much smoke up your skirt, I mean, you could use this against your wife and be like, listen to what this guy's saying. He's saying I'm talented. It's on record. But you are very talented and multi-talented across cross-platforms, Spencer.
Thank you.
Yes, you're very welcome. But do you think that has helped influence how you look, the lens that you look at your Wing Chun? The lens that you look through your Goju with. And could you maybe elaborate on that a little bit?
Absolutely. I definitely think it plays a role. I think it kind of maybe taps into just some ways that my brain processes information, or the way that I learn, or the way that I express things. I think it's a very visual expression, whether I'm learning or whether I'm demonstrating something or doing something or creating something. I think I have some strong connection to just like visual representations of things. And so, for instance, within like martial arts, if I'm learning a form, I'm going to learn that form like ASAP. Not necessarily because, or I'm at least going to learn the sequence. I'm not all the fine nuances or any of that kind of stuff, but I'm going to learn the sequence of something pretty much right off the bat, just because I remember it well. But I also have a tendency to practice like crazy. So that plays a role, but it is very easy for me to pick up something new and understand what's going on. Also, if I am, you know, watching something, I think that I have, somewhat of a kind of keen ability to almost like feel what I'm seeing when I'm like watching demonstrations of like martial arts, like the way that people generate power. You can just kind of, I mean, I think this probably comes with a lot of people that practice martial arts in general, but like you can see someone demonstrating something and it's not like, oh, I can see that they have a bunch of physical muscle or something like that. It's not that, but you can see the way that they're working their body is a way that you know how to work your body to generate power in a certain way. I think I'm able to like visually pick up on that in a lot of situations. And so I can see something that, here's a good example. I was talking to my buddy Reggie, and he is someone that I talk to martial arts with a ton. And, we were talking about, Babu Lien from Calling Crane, Ming Hanshuan. We were talking about Babu Lien, and I have not had personal hands-on practice with anybody teaching me that form. But I was just watching a video that he had sent over, and it's not that I was watching it and I learned this form as a result, but I was watching the form and I was like, I can literally see where this would directly translate into something that, you know, I practice already or could be practicing or could be incorporating. So I think it's, you know, if you have that, like that visual ability to recognize that stuff, that's a huge benefit. And I think for me, it probably comes with just my, I guess, aptitude for visual stuff in general.
All right, I'm going to keep going. You just found judo. Tell us why.
Oh, yeah.
How? Tell us how, why, when, where, and what has it done for you? I'll tell you something funny. I have not forgotten you sending me that little text over Instagram. You're like, I don't get how a little woman can throw my big ass around that easily. It was something to that level. So. What is judo kind of, open the door for you in the world of, martial arts?
So first of all, I just want to credit, her name was Vaughn. She sent me into another dimension is what it felt like. But, yeah. We were just like trading throws and oh my goodness. She had just took Ippunsei Uenage on me and my life flashed before my eyes. But, judo, sure. So, well, honestly, it turns out like, I was kind of thinking about this earlier in the year and I was like, man, I got like weird connection. I actually have more connections in kind of like the martial arts community than I had originally recognized. Anyway, so I knew some people who practiced judo. Their family was involved with like the Obukan Judo, school in Oregon, which is, the one that, you know, like Jigoro Kano came and visited Oregon and went there and gave it its name and yada, yada, yada. I know some people that, are, you know, deeply connected there. My roommate in college from Japan became a judo teacher in Ghana after college.
Oh, wow.
He has also kicked my ass once. but anyways, I had just recognized that I had like some connections to judo. My wife had mentioned, she was like, hey, did you know there's like a judo school? Like there's like a judo dojo, like literally like 2 minutes away. And I was like, no, I didn't know about that. But anyways, I like remembered that. And I was like, you know what? Since I practice so much stuff that's close range, I can admit that I have focused a lot of my time more on striking and seizing, not so much takedowns, grappling. And I was like, you know what? I need somewhere to just, you know, I need to get on the mats and actually just feel this and experience it and understand it. And a lot of it makes perfect sense because it's a very well thought out system that works on basic mechanics. A lot of it makes perfect sense. I have discovered that it is an entirely different level of physicality that I need to get my body used to. Definitely can drain you. And one thing that I'm actually really, really finding actually a little bit more similar to Wing Chun, not necessarily in how movement is done, but how it's presented and practiced, is footwork. So the footwork in judo, has been, I feel like, it's like achievement unlocked kind of thing. Like, you've accessed another level, of practice. I feel that it actually does, relate to Goju very well, very well. And yeah, so, you know, judo is definitely this, I'm a little bummed. I haven't been able to practice for like 2 weeks because of just like complications to like work scheduling, but, so I'm like fiending for it now. But, no, I've found it's a really cool complementary thing to work into what I practice. Again, it's another thing that is non-contradictory. I wouldn't necessarily want to be practicing multiple arts that focused on completely different mechanics, but I can take the mechanics from judo once I'm in that close range. And I can say, okay, well, I might use, my entering, techniques or tactics or whatever, that might come from Wing Chun, or it might come from Goju, or it might be a kind of just like mesh of the two. But once I'm there, do I want to go into this kind of thing? A lot of the time, if you're that close and you can actually get a good like takedown, I don't know. That's just something I want to kind of work in a little bit more.
Cool.
It's been really fun though. Super rewarding. Good.
Have you done any of the ground grappling?
Absolutely. I feel like I'm actually, so I'm really tall. I'm about 6'5". So obviously in judo, that does not necessarily, that's not maybe not the best situation, right? Being super tall in judo, unless you're practicing with people that are the same height as you. And that's often never the case for me. So my hips below other people's hips kind of stuff, bit of a task. So I have noticed that the long legs help out in a couple different ways. With some of just like your, ashiwaza and like sweeps and foot techniques and things like that can cover a little bit of ground. I like that. I can step back further. I can step in more aggressively. I can extend my leg further to block or sweep. I'm by no means like super efficient at it, but I feel that that's maybe an area where I would have some strengths. Same thing with like the newaza and like the grappling work, shimewaza. I have noticed that I can create a really big base with like how big of a triangle I can create with my legs and my torso. My torso is pretty long. I would say I have more longer torso than long legs, but again, 6'5", my legs are longer than most people's anyways. So when I'm down there, I can create big bridges, for getting my hips out. I can, again, create like larger triangles for creating like a base, just my weight over somebody. Again, not by no means like crazy proficient, but that feels like areas where as I continue with judo, that's where my strengths might be.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Do you feel that there's a, and I don't know that much about judo, but I know that there's some differences between say like, Olympic wrestling rules and then maybe what was originally taught by, Kano back in the day. And I don't know if you, have a sense of, what those differences might have been or, how they impact your practice of judo or judo in general.
Yeah. So I think the things that have been like taken out have been, I'm like loosely familiar with it. It's just things that they're trying to improve, like the flow of the sport or reduce injuries and whatever it is, right? Mm-hmm. Prevent people from kind of just like stalling, whatever. So actually my practice in judo is a little interesting. So I, since this spot is like right by my house, I just reached out and I was just like, hey, I'm moving away at the end of the year. Look, I practice these things. They're close range based stuff. Would you guys mind if I came in and practiced with you? Not looking for rank, not looking for anything, super crazy, just literally looking to get in there to be a body, to feel things. So at this point, like, I really don't, have too much experience within judo, just a handful of months really. But again, been a super beneficial practice. Again, a different level of physicality that's been really fun to figure out. So my practice with judo, I can see where there's a lot of crossover actually with some mechanics that I find within Goju specifically, actually. Certain things from kata, certain things from bunkai where it's like, oh, that's the same thing. or that could be interpreted as the same thing.
Sure.
So that's the angle I'm really kind of looking at judo from is when can judo pick up in like a progression of whatever I'm doing when, sure. when can training and those mechanics kind of take over? And I'm just trying to figure it all out. I'm just trying to be a sponge right now. I'm just trying to feel everything.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. Cool. That's great. It's part of the journey. Question for you, because you mentioned, you know, the footwork, and you'd had some aha moments with the judo. Do you find that, so with the judo, and then you could backtrack this maybe to Goju or even Wing Chun, do you find that understanding the footwork in a different context, more for the throw or the sweep or the takedown, do you find that you're understanding how the footwork puts you into position to execute whatever that throw, sweep, or takedown might be, and you're kind of having the aha moment there, like how important it is to be in that right position? Mm-hmm. So the whole structure when you're taking somebody down is proper, or is it in a different context?
So my kind of like aha moment, well, I don't know if I would say it was an aha moment. I do feel like it was kind of like opening up a new door a little bit, is, you know, like my understanding of footwork largely comes from Wing Chun. And so like my footwork in terms of entering kind of techniques, or how I want to get under somebody's spine or around like a leg or something like that, a lot of what I have like just physically practiced has been a lot of that. But the thing is, a lot of those mechanics that you find in Goju, which has very similar stepping, a lot of those mechanics that you'll find just directly translate to how you'd want to set up something in judo. And so the way that you engage the core, coordinate things with like the upper body and waist and legs, all that kind of, it's more overlap. It's not stuff that's contradictory to one another. And so I basically have just been like, okay. Yeah. I can like, this would work here, or this would work for that. Or, oh, I already know how to do that. I just need to do it in this kind of, you know, this kind of order so that the throw will work out, or the sweep will work out, or whatever it is. So that's kind of where I'm looking at it in terms of like the footwork, and where I'm most impressed. And there's just like a really high level of detail, at least where I practice judo, that focuses on that. And I just like that high level of detail.
Awesome. Sounds like you found a good group, even though you're only there for a little bit longer.
Yeah, they're a bunch of really cool guys. Some people that live in the neighborhood, some people that live further away, people of all ages, people of all sizes. Very welcoming. It's a little bit probably more low key than some like competition focused schools. Very much of like a machi dojo kind of thing, like a city town dojo, not a big club kind of thing, more of just like the hometown area where people practice, you know, practice their martial arts. It's got that kind of a feel, which is very welcoming. But it also takes a lot of pressure off you too. Not necessarily pressure, but it makes the environment very easy to be around. So yeah, it's a great group. Love those guys. Hopefully I can figure out my work scheduling a little bit better for my evening hours.
You have a big life-changing event coming up for you and your family. Would you share with the audience what that is? And did you already buy a house over there? And is it no? Yes, no?
No. So yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah. So, I mean, yeah. So, my family and I was going to make a joke or something, but I backed off on that one. I was going to say on December 25th or something like that, I turn into a dragon. No.
There you go.
No. Yeah. So, close to the end of the year, it's a little bit of a moving target right now, but we are moving to Japan. So I had lived there when I was younger. My wife is from Japan. Children have dual citizenship. The only thing that would prevent us from living there before was just visa status, for me, which I can obviously get a spouse visa. So visa status for me. And work. And so my work now, since I primarily focus on Japan and Asia Pacific, me being in that time zone, me being in Japan is pretty important. Also we just filled out all of our, visa documentation. We're just waiting for it to show up. So I think we turned it in like late September. We've been married for almost 14 years now. I've been in the Japanese Koseki, the family record, for the same amount of time. Wow. So really no hiccups in moving, no hiccups in getting the visa. It's just about how long it takes to process. But once it does, essentially, that's when everything goes into high gear. We've been prepping for the move and, you know, just getting things in order a little bit. Still got to sell the house. But that's kind of coming along as it is. I don't have a house in Japan yet. We will probably stay with my in-laws until we do find something. But we have an area that we're looking at. We have an area for some international schools for our daughters that we're looking at. It's going to be funny on the flip side now. My older daughter, she's been in the Japanese immersion program. We only speak Japanese in our household. So she was in the Japanese immersion program throughout her entire education so far to make sure that her Japanese, at least the academic standards, get up to where they need to be. Her speech is great. But now it's going to be the flip side. We're going to be in Japan, and we want to make sure that our daughters can properly learn English because we have some kind of weird aversion to speaking English inside the home. Not really. It's just kind of naturally forming. But yeah, we want to make sure that they can keep up with their English and make sure that it stays up to good standards so they can communicate with family, all that kind of stuff. So we know the area that we're looking at. It's just we got to get on the ground and find our spot.
Awesome.
Do you have any future plans for any kind of martial arts training while you're there?
Yep. So my sensei definitely wants me to teach. He wants me to open something up. We're operating under the idea that that's actually what will be happening. But I'm not going to rush anything. My kind of like step-by-step plan is to teach one or both of my, in-laws, brother-in-laws, one or both of them, get them up to a level of general proficiency where they could assist with like, you know, practice and teaching and things like that, which that'll take some time. Mm-hmm. And throughout that time, kind of just like gradually look for maybe, you know, other people who want to practice, people who are in the area who either want to get some like English practice in with their martial arts. That's like an angle we'll take, or an angle that I want to take. Obviously people over here, when they practice like their kihon and their basics, they count off in Japanese, they call their techniques off in Japanese or what, you know, Chinese systems as well using, the respective terms. I want to take the kind of like the opposite angle and all the detailed stuff explained in Japanese. And all the basics go, okay, this is where you can practice some English. And ultimately use that as like an area where people can also practice English, because that's like a weird little niche thing that I'm sure some people already do. But you know, it gives people an opportunity. It'll give people an opportunity to A, practice martial arts, and B, get some English practice in. So, that's something that I want to try to explore. But yeah, it'll be step by step. We'll figure it out. I am looking forward to it, and I am looking forward to, teaching more regularly. I do have some experience in teaching, and I've definitely been called upon countless times throughout my life to, you know, actually do teaching in class or teach particular things or, done some private things as well with people. So I think this will just be a new chapter in understanding how all that works.
Nice. Very cool.
That's going to be wildly interesting that a American Caucasian we'll be teaching a Japanese art in Japan.
We'll see. And I mean, it's part pretty.
It's not to pick on you. I think it's unique. I think it's cool. You and I have talked quite a bit, through Instagram about your big transition into teaching. And I will tell you that, you know, having Sifu Russ on, myself working with, Owen over there, my co-host, Sifu Mayer, you know, with his PhD in educational psychology and cognitive development. I just had my third episode of Warriorship conversing with Coach Kevin Zakours, who was working on a high school teaching degree, and that didn't work out. So he became a martial arts instructor and teacher. You will find that your art, your system, your style, how you look at it and that lens you look at it will change, and hopefully for the better, and hopefully it will refine your own skills. So, I'm excited for you to take, you're our first guest, frankly, that's actually taking the step into teaching. You've been a long time practitioner, but now you're actually moving to a foreign land and taking a step into teaching. So that's pretty cool, man. That's really cool.
Yeah. I mean, it is kind of funny, the concept of like, oh yeah, some gigantic 6'5" white dude teaching, you know, Japanese or Okinawan by extension. martial art in the motherland. You know, it's a little far fetched, but I do think there are some angles that people can, there are angles that I can explore that will help people. Obviously, if people want to practice within, just like the English framework, I can help with that. I don't really intend to actually be primarily teaching in English. I'm sure that especially if I'm like working with like my in-laws, I'm not going to speak English with them. Like if I'm getting them up to speed, you know, it'll be getting my reps in, you know, just like how I want to teach, present things within Japanese. Mm-hmm. But also, I don't know, there's a lot of different, things that I could explore. You know, I think people having a large body like mine to practice with, someone that's big or someone who has a lot of like reach, it presents challenges that they might not get to actually practice all that often. Mm-hmm. Especially, you know, in Japan. So hopefully, you know, I think people will maybe like that experience and like that opportunity to, you know, work with someone who might just be able to out muscle someone, not even with muscle, just with size and mass.
Sure. You know? That's mm-hmm. exactly so, right.
Leverage. Yeah.
So I'm going to be calculated with it, and I'm going to make sure that I don't get, you know, I don't, shoot for the stars too early. But I'm excited to see how it's all going to shape up.
Mm-hmm. So if you, you've had a lot of experience with a lot of different martial arts and had a lot of teachers. Mm-hmm. And so do you feel like when you sort of move into this teaching phase that you're going to have, are you going to sort of replicate what your teachers have taught you or when maybe mm-hmm. one specific teacher or do you really feel like you're going to be able to have a chance to kind of develop your own thing along the way? How you're going to present the art maybe?
I think it has to be. So I think it, for me personally, it can't be a one-to-one copy. Mm-hmm. There's a quote I really like. I'll try to paraphrase it, but it's something along the lines of like, if you begin teaching and you teach exactly how your teacher taught, then you missed the lesson. Something mm-hmm. along those lines. I can't remember who it's from, but I really like that quote. Because you have to be able to keep something alive and growing and learning. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, obviously, it just becomes stagnant and can die off or become corrupted. But that's the thing. You have to make sure that you're not just adding in or subtracting things. I think you have to preserve what is the tradition. You have to understand what the tradition is in the first place. Then you have to preserve that. But the way that you present it or the way that you teach, that's where I think progression and innovation, or even maybe just returning to something more traditional, that's where that comes into place. So I can, mm-hmm. you know, I can tell you that, you know, certain ways that I've practiced one thing, at one point in time, I can tell that from maybe a previous example, there has been some things that have like changed. And I think that's okay. I think that's okay. So, again, so long as you understand what the tradition aspect of it is, but don't get hung up on it.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
I think a lot of people do really get hung up on the idea of tradition, and they say, whether it's accurate tradition or not, they get hung up on exactly what they've been doing, and they are unwilling to change their mind or look at things a little bit differently. And I think that's like a dangerous route to go down. So honestly, the topic of teaching, I think it does require a lot of consideration and care.
For sure.
Well said. Yep. Good question, Owen. I have a couple more things before we start to wind this down. You sure. had mentioned that you, once you get settled in over there, whether it be a year or two or even less, mm-hmm. you know, you get settled in, you get your own place, you know, you can start, rocking and rolling. And this may have to do also with training your in-laws, to make sure you have good, assistance. You had mentioned maybe thinking about kicking around the idea of maybe doing a YouTube channel. With some of the Goju Ryu, and maybe even, because that's kind of what your Instagram is. You'll, mm-hmm. you'll kind of have an idea in your head. And I always look at what you're doing on Instagram to me is a great audible visual video notebook. Cause you can go back and maybe you teach for 5 or 6 years and you look at some of your old videos. And it's like, yeah, I don't believe that anymore at all.
Oh, 100%. That's going to happen. I mean, that's going to happen. Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah. So you're thinking about doing that with YouTube. Well, cause you've got the cameras and all that other stuff, the media and stuff. How would it be a little bit different maybe than what you're doing on Instagram? Would you be more open to, okay, I got an email maybe you have a website with it. You know, like I got an email from a practitioner of Goju over in Canada and they kind of do something this way. Let's take a look at it and maybe I'll give my spin on it. Or maybe even would you be open for Wing Chun people, you know, maybe kind of doing that? What are you kind of looking to do if you do have your YouTube page, Spencer?
Yeah. So it's just going from something like Instagram to YouTube, it just kind of opens up a lot of different opportunities of what I can actually feasibly do on whatever that platform is. So Instagram, look, I do a ton of stuff at home because I literally do hyper focus out on this stuff like crazy and practice a ton, get all sorts of ideas that I want to share and talk about. But it's obviously without a partner a lot. And I think it's really important to be able to demonstrate things with an actual person.
Absolutely.
And when I'm out at my dojo or I'm hanging out with like friends that practice martial arts, I'm just not like, hey guys, I want to make a video, but I want to get to the point where I can be like, hey, we're making a video, you know, like yell over at like a student or something like that, or a friend be like, come on, we're going to make a video. We're going to demonstrate this a little bit more comprehensively and thoroughly. That's really all I kind of want to do with it. You know, if it opens up some lines of discussion with people, great. I'm probably not going to be, unless there's like something that really warrants it, I can't see myself making like response videos to certain things or referencing the way other people do things, just because I'm not trying to like, there's no part of me that wants to go bash the way that other people do things or even like come off as like I'm opposing them, you know, like I'm just not interested in that. I just want to be able to show things a little bit more comprehensively so that people can hopefully, you know, just practice it out on their own. And see if they like it, see if they want to work with it. If not, whatever. That's probably more of what I'm shooting for.
Very cool.
I have all sorts of other weird ideas like, oh, I want to get like a van that I can sleep in and call it the Gojuban, you know, like Gojuban, put a big number 50 on it or something like that. Goju meaning 50, in just like numerical terms, like all these like stupid, like little ideas like that, where I'm like, oh yeah. And then I could just like travel around to different dojos and like meet people and be like, hey, show me like what you think is like a really cool thing in your system. And like, obviously I could go off and do all those kind of things, but man, that would be getting way too ahead of myself. It'd be fun though. It'd be fun.
Your wife might put a damper on some of that too, though.
I have a strong feeling that's probably the case. Hey, sorry, I'm going to be gone every weekend for the rest of our lives.
Yes.
Oh, did you have
your YouTube channel? Yeah.
That's right, honey. As long as it brings in the cash, right? Did you have any last questions for our friend?
I don't think so. Yeah.
Okay.
I think I asked most of them.
So I mentioned this if you were going to be on the show.
Uh-huh.
And I'm welcome to, I would be more than happy to start this because Owen doesn't know. He's like, you son of a gun. Why don't you fill me in on this? So here's my question. Did you have any questions for us, as a group or personally or anything like that? Or maybe as somebody that's stepping into teaching? Cause Owen and I have, I want to say a little bit more than 15 years each. I think I'm hitting the 16 or 17 year mark here, at least with the Wing Chun. So if you had any questions,
you know what?
And I'll dive on the grenade first. So yeah.
Okay. This is not going to be about teaching. This is not going to be about teaching modalities. This is not going to be about structure type, not technique stuff, not structure stuff. Why don't you guys, if you wouldn't mind, talk a little bit about what you think makes a good positive environment for practicing and training martial arts. Doesn't matter what the style is, but what creates a good environment for people to practice and learn? You don't have to go crazy with it, but I like hearing people talk about this.
Okay. So for me, I honestly didn't realize what it was, probably because I had it with my Wing Chun group and I've had it in Owen's school, but I didn't understand what it was on a verbal concept until I actually listened to a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu podcast 3 years ago. And it was my friend Josh McKinney, who just became a first-time dad at 28. And
congratulations, Josh.
Yeah, way to go, Josh. Josh McKinney of the I Second Jiu-Jitsu podcast. And it was actually a topic that Owen and I talked about. And it was training safety. And it was also having multiple goals for different students. Okay. Let me explain both of those. So Josh was like, when we're working on a drill, when we are working on light sparring, you are not there to hurt that other person. You are trying to help them learn and make you better. But in the process, you are also helping your partner getting better. So, and I think that this is something that's on the shoulders of the coach, the sensei, the sifu, whatever hat or title they're wearing. They need to start the class with an understanding of that. We are here to train. We are not here to hurt each other. So there can be levels of discomfort. I mean, you know, Owen might throw an arm lock on me. He's like, how's that feel? I'm like, doesn't feel good. He's like, okay, well then it's set correctly, you know, or, you know, it could be a pock punch drill. When I start off pock punch drill, my pock sows, if I'm sparring somebody, my pock sows are as heavy as any of my strikes because I'm trying to strike your center line. Mm-hmm. Your arm just happens to be in the way. So when I look at pock sow, I look at it more like a palm strike to your balance than just a deflecting hand. Mm-hmm. But if I did that kind of force on a rookie that walked in the first day in the school that had no understanding of their own body, no understanding of their own stance, and started blasting away on them, that's gonna have somebody walk away.
They'd be out.
They're out. They're not into it. So understanding that the people that you're drilling with, when you're drilling, you're working on skill development. You're not working on dominating the person. We're not into competition mode, right? And that was from a sport that I heard this from. And I'm like, I can directly interact that into my martial arts. And when I teach, when I'm a teacher in a traditional Chinese system like Wing Chun, I can integrate that into my own classroom. And then the second one that Josh talked about that I really loved is having people in the class that want different things, right? He's got competitors in his class that are world-class competitors. And then he's got Bob down the street that's in his 40s that comes to class twice a week and just wants to get some physical fitness and roll around. So you can have a school that teaches one thing with a lot of different, maybe little pods of people or groups that are working on the same thing with different intensities. And then when one of your, you know, like say Mikey's like a world-class competitor. When he goes to work with Bob, it's my job as the teacher in that school to be like, hey, Mikey, turn everything down and I want you to help Bob on his level and know that Bob's not competing. So yeah. I think having that kind of understanding as a teacher to dial people up or dial them down and have those different ranges of intensity and actually have people that understand, hey, we're here to work together and make people better. We're here to help make each other better. That was something that I had always had, but I didn't have a verbal representation of what I had, how I was being taught and how our schools were. Because my Wing Chun club was like that and Owen's club is like that. And I think it's a blessing. And I've had two world-class schools that have done that style of teaching.
So, you know, really quick, as you mentioned that, that reminds me of something that you see in karate quite a bit. You'll see people kind of offering, especially in like structure training kind of practice, like Sanchin, Shime and this kind of stuff. You'll see people, basically not knowing how to gauge, working with different partners, right? And so the level of like resistance that I can fight through is going to be different from the person next to me. But you'll see people basically trying to like, if they're doing like the testing or offering some kind of resistance, you'll find people that tend to just offer that exact same amount of resistance to every single person. And what they end up doing is they're not helping the person address where there's a weakness. They're preventing them from doing the form or preventing them from doing what they need to be doing. They're breaking their practice. They're not actively improving it. So no, that is a very, very, very good point. And it's something that obviously, as mentioned, it relates to stuff that we find within karate. Owen, you're next on the hotspot.
That's a complicated question. It's a big one.
It is. It does, I mean, you don't have to go crazy, but yeah.
I think it's an important one. And for me, being on sort of both sides of the fence is, you know, a practitioner and being a teacher for a long time. First of all, I would say that I think it's the teacher that sets the tone for how things are going to go in the class. And, and that really sets the type of environment that the students are going to practice in. And in my experience, you know, I would go back to what, you know, kind of Randall was saying is you're going to have a broad, if you're planning on teaching, you know, a public class of any sort, then you're going to have kind of a broader spectrum of people who are going to come to that class with different, they're going to have different wants. They're going to have different needs. They're each coming for sort of individual reasons. And you're going to have, you know, a smaller sliver of people who are going to be really serious about it. And you're going to have a broader swath of people who are, you know, they're there for their own reasons, whatever that is. Some people are self-defense. Some people it's for fitness, some people. And so if your art can sort of help them meet those needs, and kind of meet them where they're at, I think that that sort of, for me, that's always been kind of the first thing. And then I would say sort of the second thing is that, you know, that the boundaries are sort of clearly laid out about people. My class has always been helping everybody get better. So it's like the person who is better is helping the person who is less better, for lack of a better set of terms. But, And I think that as long as that's clearly laid out and that people understand that that's the function, is we're all here to help each other get better. So if you have in Randall's example, you have a student who has a lot of experience or may be performing at a high level, can meet somebody else who is, you know, maybe just there for a couple of times a week. You know, they're more casual. They're there for different reasons. And if they can meet that person on their level, and then, and this has always been my thing, it's like what I tell my students who are at a higher level is like, hey, stop and try to find something that you're not good at, or something maybe you need to practice. Turn down the volume and then go practice with that person. Because you're working there, they have a broad skill set that's fairly deep if they've been there a while. And the person who is maybe less experienced has a lesser skill set that may not be as deep. So you can, that the person who has all that experience can find one or two things that they need to work on specifically, and then maybe be able to just work on that. And it may be a technique, it may be a principle, it may be a skill set. It may, you know, there's a lot of things within the context of all martial arts that need to get worked on. Mm-hmm. So that's the guidance I try to sort of provide my students with any kind of interaction, whether it's drills or push hands or whatever. So yeah.
I really like that a lot. I like hyper focusing on certain things when you recognize that there's a deficiency that that you need to work on. And it's not just like your instructor's pointing it out to you. It's you actually understanding that you need to self-correct.
Yep.
Yeah. And learning the skill set to even be able to recognize that. Yeah. That's probably something that, you know, you need to feel hand-to-hand transmission style, with your instructor first.
Yep.
But, oh no, I really like that.
You know, something Owen said, and I've heard it before, but I didn't really piecemeal it out to the point where I'm like, oh, the way he said that, that was great. Is Owen talked about, you know, you're going to have people there for fitness. You know, there are people, you know, for self-defense, for, you know, maybe they more a traditional practice. Yep. Some people just want to practice in and of itself. So that's going to be another thing. That's going to be another hat that you're going to have to wear, maybe the dissection hat of, do you know how to dissect Goju and bring out the fitness parts of it? Do you know how to dissect Goju and bring out the classical parts of it? Do you know how to dissect Goju into people that really are hyper focused on a self-defense side? You know, can you work with people that maybe want to compete with it? And I'm going to tell you something. I can do all that stuff with Wing Chun, but some of it I'm better at. And trying not to be a teacher that fits for everybody, that's going to take time and practice.
Yeah,
because Owen and I are both to the point where we don't teach for a living. We teach because we love it. And because we have 9-to-5 jobs that pay us, pretty well, not great, but pretty well. We also have the ability, and Owen's mentioned this a bunch, to be, if you're not helping out the school, if you're not there to learn, and if you're discourteous or it's just not working out, you know, we might either say screw off, or we might say maybe there's another school. Owen has another way of saying it. Maybe there's another school that might fit you better. And so I try to tear apart Wing Chun and look at it through as many lenses as possible. But I also realize that I might not be the best teacher. We might not be compatible as a student and a teacher. And that's, you're going to have to be okay with that, you know, cause you can't be everything for everybody as a teacher. Right. So that's just another two cents.
Go ahead. Oh, I was going to say, it's funny that you mentioned that actually, because there's one thing. I mean, my wife keeps me in check. She keeps me in check and she keeps me grounded, you know, like keeping me in reality a little bit. And the other day she was like, I was probably griping about something. I don't know what it was, but she was like, Spencer, you need to like adjust your, expectations of why other people practice martial arts. And I was like, damn it. I do have to do that. Huh? Like I do need to learn how to do that better. Because like you said, obviously people get into it for different reasons. People are going to have different levels of interests. But I think one thing I mentioned to you was I'm going to set this as like a baseline goal, and whether I achieve it or not is, that doesn't matter. But whether I shoot for it is what matters for me. I hope to, when I am teaching at a consistent rate or whatever, I hope to get people to enjoy martial arts. Doesn't have to be a style specific thing, but I hope I am able to get people to enjoy martial arts as much as I do. So I know that's probably a tall task in some cases.
That's a tall task, buddy.
But it's a good thing to shoot for, I think. So I'm going to try to operate around that. And just like tap into what has been interesting about martial arts to me, what I like about it, and hopefully see if it resonates with other people. Again, if not, and they just want practice for sweat and all that kind of stuff, sweet.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be like, oh, if you're not here to become Billy Badass, you can't join my dojo. It's not going to be like that.
Yeah, my last thing I was just gonna say is, you know, I always tell people when they come, when we start doing drills, or we start, you know, a new student starts doing that, I say, okay, listen, so my rules is like, my first rule is like, I think everybody should come and have fun, because I like to have fun when I practice martial arts, you know, and I'm serious about it. I've been a very serious practitioner for a long time, but I can still have fun. Mm-hmm. And then the second thing is nobody gets hurt. Yeah. Because I've had just innumerable amounts of injuries. I've been through that. I've had students who've been injured and so on and so forth. So it's just everybody tried that we're all going to try to stay healthy so that we can all come back next week, or we can all come back and, you know, on Monday or whatever it is. So, you know, those are kind of my base rules.
Absolutely. Sidelining yourself is the worst. I have been injured so much. And it's like, I hate sidelining myself in that manner. Yeah. Like having to actively, if I'm injured, I hop out to the dojo a lot anyways, cause I can at least help other people out, you know, like even if I'm not like throwing things around. So but it's hard to take yourself out and actually rest. And obviously as you get older, you got to rest more, which makes it even worse.
Yep.
Wait, but then hopefully the practice makes you healthier. So I don't know.
It's that two-edged sword, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Spencer, our music guy doesn't practice martial arts, I hate to say. So if he ever does, maybe we'll have him on the show, because you guys have been the kind of background guys that have been a big part of our show. Everyone,
that's true.
Everyone loves the logos. Everyone loves the artwork. Mm-hmm. And that you actually happen to be a legitimate martial arts practitioner, that I think that's awesome. Thank you for your help for the show, and good luck to you and your family. That is a huge life change and a huge move. And thanks for being on, man. And we will, you know, since right now you don't have the YouTube channel up, we will put your Instagram in the show notes, because you've got a pretty good following on Instagram of martial arts geeks that love what you're doing. And, you know, we're some of them over here. So thank you for your time. And is there any last thing that you wanted to talk about real quick?
Actually, since you mentioned those martial arts geeks, I just want to say massive thank you to literally everybody that engages with me, you know, like mainly on Instagram, obviously, but everybody that I've been able to like build up relationships with, there's something about that that I really value, because there's so much, just to put it bluntly, shit talking on martial arts, social media and all that kind of stuff.
Absolutely.
I steer clear of that. The people that I have been having amazing discussions with have been awesome people that practice. I truly value all of their feedback, and their kindness and all this stuff. They're awesome people. Thank you all so much. And thank you guys, obviously, for letting me be here and chat about stuff. Even if I was fueled by coffee and rambling. So I appreciate it.
That was great.
Thank you, Spencer.
All right.
Have a great day, my friend.
See you later, fellas. Yep.
Have a good one.
Bye-bye. Adios.